Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I'm Jason Snell. This is episode number 38. Across the internet from me, the chief TV critic of The Hollywood Reporter, your host, Mr. Tim Goodman. Welcome home.
Thank you, Jason. It's good to be home.
You were in Texas and you were in Canada.
Yes, two far-flung places that you normally do not associate with one another.
No, other than that they're, you know, one of them is a country in its own right, and one of them is a country in its own mind. So,
yes,
there you go.
Isn't that it? That's very good. That's very clever of you. So, yes, I was in Austin.
Yeah,
for the ATX Festival, the TV festival going into its, now they call them seasons, fourth season, which was its biggest one yet by far. Breakaway, big thing. I was there. I think Thursday through Sunday, and on Sunday I departed for Alberta, Canada, and Banff. And I was in Banff at the World Media Festival through Wednesday. So I'm fresh back off the plane.
Wow. That's a lot. Yeah. Any nice highlights from those? Anything really stick out to you that you enjoyed doing?
Yes, actually. I enjoyed my time in both places immensely. You know, Austin, I love it. It's not only is it just a great food town.
You get some beer, get some barbecue.
I did, yeah, I did. I probably should have done a little more of that. I probably should have made a little bit more time for the food. I was a little bit where I didn't have a car, but mostly things come up. You know, you're at a festival and somebody says, let's go do this and let's go do that, and things change the last second. So I probably could have done better time. I will say that I was getting great advice for all my food. From one Jimmy Kimmel.
Wow.
Yes, Kimmel had sent me an email, where it was a very detailed email. He's a foodie, and he's been to Austin a number of times, I think for South by Southwest. And he documents every place he goes. He takes long notes. And so he sent me a copy of that. It is very detailed. And I couldn't even get to a fraction of the places that he mentioned. But what I liked about it, Jason, the things that I did a panel with Brooklyn Nine-Nine. That was a lot of fun.
That was
very
great.
Funny. Yeah. Yeah, it was so great. So, and then I did a panel with Rectify, and that was really good. We actually got to see the first episode of the third season. We had to screen that for everybody, and it's great, and it continues the season. And the people, you know, Abigail Spencer and Aidan Young are tremendous people, and they, you know, I got to go to lunch with those guys. In fact, they were very accommodating. They were ready to hang out and do all kinds of things, and I spent a lot of time with them. They are good people. And then did a couple of other panels, including one with fellow TV critics and writers about what we do. And I did one panel, the last panel, which was a bunch of showrunners talking about what they could do between seasons to keep their keep their viewers intact, which
we talk about that a lot.
Yes, and I so that was right in my wheelhouse. I actually created that panel, and I did create the one for the TV critics as well. And the interesting thing was in the panel about how do you hold an audience, and can you do this, and will you do that, et cetera, et cetera. The answer uniformly among the four people on the panel, let me tell you who they were: Bo Willimon from House of Cards, Noah Hawley from Fargo, Graham Manson from Orphan Black,
right? Yeah. Yep.
And Mickey Fisher from Extant and CBS. And so we had everybody from different platforms. We had a lot of different ideas. Uniformly, I think Mickey Fisher would probably do something because he was open for anything. Nobody wanted to do anything. No one was interested in any change whatsoever. I found that, you know, I was not the reaction I thought I was going to get, but I rolled with it because it's them. We were trying to work it out in the room. As I said, let's just talk about this in the room. Nobody has any ideas. No one has any answers. We just want to think about it. But, you know, they made a lot of good points. Basically what they said was, let's not they didn't want to create any more content that they would have had to create on their own. There wasn't enough time. They were overworked and overstressed. They didn't want to water down the content in any way just by trying to make something on the side. And generally resistant to lots of ideas. And in fact, all ideas.
So I guess they figure they're in the business of creating, in most of their cases, you know, 40 to 45 minute long pieces of entertainment that you watch on a screen, and they make a certain number of those, and then they rest and they do it again. And the idea of saying, well, now we also want you to take your characters and adapt them to things that are 5 minutes or that are web pages or whatever, and I guess I can kind of understand their approach as people who make television and saying, well, I just want to make television. I wonder if 21st century, being a showrunner, it needs to be more than that, like needs to be like the steward of a brand, or, you know, that it's like the Orphan Black brand belongs to you and you need to want be the, you know, doing everything. Or do they really feel like, look, that's the network's problem. All we're obligated to do and all we can do maybe is deliver them, you know, 10 episodes and then walk away.
Yeah, I would respectfully disagree with their reaction, which is meaning I would kind of agree with you. I understood where they were coming from. But I don't think it's reflective of the real world, certainly not for those shows that would be struggling and will need to do anything to keep an audience, much less grow an audience. But you know, it was interesting in and of itself, because it wasn't just like one guy saying, I don't want to do it. It was literally all four of them. Although, like I said, I think Mickey Fisher, who was the youngest one as far as experience on the crew by far on the panel, I think he would do something because he's a sci-fi guy. He likes extra content. I think that his problem is that CBS just doesn't really know what to do with that. Right. I mean, Extant is already a summer series, and you know they're going through a pretty dramatic shake up in the cast. Halle Berry's still on there, but they're shaking up the cast pretty strongly. So they probably had a lot to do already, and they didn't want to add anything to it. But yeah, I respectfully disagreed with them, but I am also not a creator. I just felt like I was seeing it from my perspective of looking at the industry as an industry analyst, right. And they were looking at it as content providers. And there was no coming together of the minds.
It is really interesting that they all felt that way. I've seen this in industries where you get people who are resistant to change, and it's not that they're bad people. It's that they know how to do their job. And right, and these are people who know how to make television. That's their job. And I've got to think that at some point, somebody who is in their business, in their line of work, is going to do something that's really successful, and their job is going to get redefined. And if I were in their shoes, I would really be hesitant to have somebody who isn't, you know, reporting to me creating that stuff, right?
Yes.
Because
mm-hmm.
because then it's, you know, not only is it like not canonical, but it's also like not up to you're the one who's creating all the material for the show. And if your network says, oh no, we'll make some webisodes, you're like, no, I'll make the webisodes. And then somebody will do it and do it well, and everybody else will be like, oh, I guess that's part of my job now. Because like, yeah. Stephen Moffat said that at, I think, Edinburgh Television Festival earlier this year, late last year, he said, we should be making, you know, Doctor Who episodes for the internet that are like 10 minutes long and 18 minutes long and 4 minutes long. And just, you know, the future is much broader than what we think. And we're not just making widgets that you drop down in 45 minute blocks. And so maybe it'll be somebody like him, somebody from outside of North America, maybe that some network that's willing to take a chance. I don't know where it'll come from, but you know, I share your skepticism that they can just say, well, we're just going to keep making shows and it'll all be fine. Because I've heard that too many times before, right? We'll just keep doing newspapers. We'll still keep doing magazines. It's like, yeah, no, you're not. The world is changing and you're going to have to change whether you like it or not. So I'm disappointed that one of them didn't like step up and say, yes, we'll do it. But then they'd be making more work for themselves, right?
Well, that was definitely part of it. It was the additional work. It was control. It was, would the cast be interested in that? Could they even ask the cast to
right.
do that?
Their deals so, might not even cover it.
Right. And there was enough. But you know what? At the same time, I just thought it was funny because everybody had their own reasons. And, you know, I finally had to say that the person who was the outlier on the panel was Bo Willimon, because I said, well, listen, Bo, you work for a company that doesn't talk about ratings. Everybody else, the other three, are ratings driven. So no one knows whether your show is doing well or not. They're just taking their word for it. So if he doesn't have to worry about ratings, of course he doesn't want to change anything. Everybody else is, yeah, I don't want to change anything, and then you come back one season and you're down a million viewers, then you might start thinking twice about it.
Hmm.
And
for Orphan Black is a good example of like a show that needs to hold on to its audience, right? You would
it
think.
Does. But and they also, you know, we did one of the things that we talked about is how sci-fi viewers definitely are more loyal. They, you know, they'll listen, they'll send stuff out from the Clone Club. It's a, you know, in some ways, as Graham Manson was saying, a lot of that stuff is being done for them. You know, this quote unquote Clone Club of fans stay engaged, like almost like a sports club. They stay engaged. And they don't lose interest, and they do come back. They're hyper fans. But the, you know what? In fairness to everybody on the panel, a lot of people had really good points, and I got what they were saying. I don't necessarily agree with it, and I got it, and I also understood the restrictions that they had. It was interesting. It was not the panel that it was not the way the panel I thought was going to go. On the other hand, I love the fact that it was super wonky, and that we talked inside baseball stuff, and the crowd from Austin that was there was totally into it. So I was digging that. That was awesome. Fun.
That's awesome.
And then once I got to Banff, the thing that I liked about Banff, the panels that I liked there were, you know, they were different. They were kind of all over the map. It's much more industry. Although I did interview Adam Reed, who created Archer. And he and I sort of get along like gangbusters when we have time to get along like gangbusters. He's a very, very nice person. They only give us a half an hour, and they only give us a half an hour for Jaime Camille, who is the Rogelio from Jane the Virgin, who's, you know, the guy's like so huge. He's got like 6 billion internet fans, so you only give this guy a half an hour. It's so easy to get through those half an hours, but you also don't want to be underprepared. But both of those were fun. I had a couple of industry things that were – I interviewed Joe Lewis, who's the head of creative development and content at Amazon Studios. So his take on what's coming in the future is really interesting. And then I did a panel of people who were just trying to talk about the allure and why the industry is going towards, as we say, limited series. Mm-hmm.
Sounds good. We actually have a limited series to talk about today, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
A sort of re-upped limited series. Limited series return.
Yes.
So True Detective is back.
Oh boy. Yeah. It is back. And look, if you pour over any of these podcasts, and I'm sure I know I've said it a number of times, we could ask Indy Sarah, who's, you know, she binged 35 of these or whatever, and she would probably know it by which exact episode. But I did say that I think that of the returning series, like a True Detective and Fargo has got a better shot of being as good as the first episode or as the first season. I thought it was going to be much harder for True Detective to pull it off twice because it was kind of a skate. It was kind of like a, you know, Bambi on ice situation with that series anyway. And it was kind of grounded by, you know, that Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson being so great.
Right.
And an incredible director who won an Emmy, Cary Fukunaga. And I don't think the same things are in play here. I watched the first 3 episodes that HBO gave us, 3 of 8. It premieres the 21st, I think. I can't remember what day it premieres, but maybe the 20. Yeah, I think it's premieres.
21st.
Yeah, 21st. True Detective is the 21st. But we came out the same day as the embargo, which was today. So you can find that on THR's site. But it's a different series. Not only do you have a different cast, you have a totally different vibe. And by that, I mean, if what you loved about True Detective the first go-around was, you know, Rust and Marty going back and forth in the car, which is what I loved about it. You know, their dialogue was so great and their acting was so great that it kind of took away from the fact that, you know, this plot is kind of twisted. And then at the ending, it was like, okay, great, we got the guy, but it doesn't really matter. This go around, Nick Pizzolatto, makes it less fluid, the dialogue. He's very staccato. It's very elliptical and clipped, and everything seems like it was every sentence, instead of being part of a dialogue, where it's like he tried to make every every utterance coming out of each actor's mouth to be something like super memorable and unforgettable. So everything seems like a quote or a quip, but not, it's never funny. There is literally no humor in the first three that I watched. And it just doesn't work. It's like they're kind of spouting cliches, trying to be deep and dark, but they're not. So it's, I don't know. And the acting is worrisome. Is that a good way to put it? Maybe. Worrisome. I worry that it's not going to get any better than the three episodes I saw. So, although Rachel McAdams, I think, is good in her role, I think that it's unfortunate that they make her smoke an e-cigarette, which is really, really bad. It just looks ridiculous. So keep that in mind when you tune it in. And when you start seeing her toke on that, remember that I said it looked ridiculous, and you will be laughing.
You're losing the swamp, the bayou for like LA freeways too, which is not, does not seem so atmospheric and interesting to me.
No, it doesn't. And you know what? Here's something that I thought was, I made a note in my notes that I thought was just going to be like, okay, first impression, just quick first thing that comes to mind is literally on the first frame, and then the few frames that followed it. I made a note that even the new song at the beginning seemed forced. And, you know, they use some of they have such great visual opening credits to the series. And they kind of employ those credits this time, but in a different way. And the song, I really do not like the song. It's a little bit too literal. It's literal. It's a little too on the mark. And I found all of that very frustrating. And then I thought, oh, that's not a good sign. And then when they decided to introduce each of these major characters, you know, you have a lot of actors. You know, you've got Vince Vaughn, and you've got Rachel McAdams, and you're trying to fit all these people in there, and they just wanted to make every character seem really broken and really troubled. And what you get out of that as a viewer is the feeling that they're trying to make everybody really troubled and really broken. Like, oh, I see what you're doing. Yeah, I see it again. Oh, I get it. Right, I see it. Her dad doesn't love her, and her sister's a prostitute or whatever. And oh, yeah, you're a drunk. Okay. Oh, wow, you really are a drunk and a coke addict. Okay, you're broken. So there was just there was too much of that. I mean, maybe I'm being too cynical. I wanted it to be better, but many, many instances of it slipping.
So your bottom line on the review made me laugh out loud, which is, let's just say it's no season one.
That's true. Yeah.
Is Rick Springfield really in True Detective?
He wasn't in the three that I saw.
So you have no visual confirmation that Rick Springfield is in it, but they say he's in it.
I will say this. If he was in the first three episodes, he didn't look like Rick Springfield. Yeah. There is a character who, after the facts, I thought, huh, could that have been Rick Springfield? That I don't think it was.
All right. How's Taylor Kitsch in this? It's like I like to do the Friday Night Lights actor check.
You know, I actually think he would do better with better material. And they kind of saddled him with a weird storyline that even after 3 hours, I'm like, I don't know what we're supposed to think about this guy.
So same producer and writer, different director, but it sounds like what you're saying is the problem is probably more in the writing than in the direction. Is that accurate?
It's actually a little of both, because Justin Lin, Fast and Furious director, does the first two episodes. Now normally the director who does the first episode sets the template for the look of this show. And I found it interesting in that Justin Lin was taking a little, and probably either Nick Pizzolatto wanted to do it or HBO wanted him to do it. They took a lot of visual influences from the first season. There's a ton of helicopter shots, which were predominant in season one. There was this moody atmospheric blend of like just showing overhead shots of freeways at night. And then cars traveling on freeways from above, just like they traveled in the bayou from above. So there were connections to the directing in season one. But what I didn't like about Justin Lin's directing, especially in the last 2 minutes of the pilot, well, it's not a pilot actually, but in the last 2 minutes of the first episode, when you watch it, you'll know what I mean. There is a scene that looks like it was straight out of a big budget Hollywood movie, like a big screen movie. And it's not the kind of stuff you see on television, which is trying to be personal and, as I said, granular. They're just really like, let's get down into these characters. This one felt like a big budget, like let's shoot their reactions and then spin the camera to the next person and then spin it to the next person. It was like they were, I don't know, they were the Avengers or something. So I was just like, buddy, that's not going to work for the True Detective. So, but and then there's a new director in the third episode, and he doesn't do much better either. So I don't know.
So you're not, you've only seen the three episodes, but you're not optimistic. They could turn around. Things could turn around, you say in your review, but it doesn't, I'm not hearing a lot of optimism from you.
Yeah. I was just covering my bases a little bit in that it could turn around, because it could. I mean, I think they had to establish that everybody's broken. They took too long to do that. I think that they created another very complicated structure, although not as complicated as the first season with the flashbacks. But the allegiances there's a cover up and there's a mystery. The allegiances are a little hard to suss out. So, you know, all of those may become clearer and then more interesting as they go on. I wanted to make sure that, you know, having only seen three of the eight, it could turn around. My professional opinion is that it will not.
I know that about you. I can read you.
You can, right?
It's not, probably not. Well, when does it turn around? It usually doesn't.
It's very rare. Yeah.
Let's see. Orange is the New Black. Is that back now or about to be back?
It was back as of a day ago, I believe. Yesterday, I believe. So, and it's good. So there's one that came back and rallied. I saw four episodes of that. I liked them all. I thought how it stretched itself out in season two was good, and it continues to do that simultaneously with making the original story of Piper and her love interest, lesbian love interest with Laura Prep on the beginning of season one. She was missing most of season two, and then she's back in season three. That is not a spoiler, by the way. And they were able to make that thing happen again and then keep up the expanded world of Orange is the New Black and the prison. And so, because you have all these great characters that people love up above and beyond Piper, so many other characters, and they keep that world alive, which would allow this series to go on as long as it wants to, because you have so many characters, you could really continue to make this show long after the Piper character's gone.
So, because there's always people coming in and out of the prison.
Yeah, there always is. And you know what? Because it's Jenji Kohan, and I think she's a great writer. I think she's wonderful at what she does. I think that her Achilles tendency, or her default problem, is that she runs shows off the rails. Like, I think Weeds went off the rails very badly.
Yep.
And so I'm always having an eye out for that to happen in Orange is the New Black. It didn't happen in the second season. It does not happen in the first four. And it looks very assured. That's the other thing. Just to touch on that for a second, Jason, you know, like we talk about True Detective. It doesn't fill me with confidence that the next five are going to be good. Whereas the first four of Orange is the New Black feel very assured, and that they know what they're doing and they're hitting on all cylinders. I think that show is going to be safe going forward.
Scott, I love to see that. As a TV viewer, you when a show comes back for its second or third season, you have that moment where you're like, oh yeah, they're machines. They know how to do this. They figured out how to make their show. And I love that, because not all shows do that.
Right. All shows do that.
I was thinking about this in regards to Sleepy Hollow, right? Where it was almost, the first season was good almost accidentally, it turns out, because the second season had problems. And you know, it's disappointing when that happens, when you know the car spins out and hits the guardrail. You know,
it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, that's the failure analysis aspect of it, right? But it's also nice when the good art stays good.
Yeah, when the good heart stays good is that's rewarding, I must say. And it does, but I love that because you're like, yes, another good season and a show I like, and it's going to continue to be great, and it's going to continue to entertain me, and I endorse entertaining myself. Hmm. Very good job, television. Thank you. But there is something perversely fascinating to me about a show that's like going great and people love it and critics saying, hey, this is fun, this is a good one. And then you can almost see them waving, hey, look, wait, look at how we did it. We're way back. And it hits the wall and you're like, oh, what a horrible accident you've got yourself into. How did you do that? Don't take your hands off the wheel. Mm-hmm. And I think with Sleepy Hollow, wasn't that a perfect example?
Yeah. Oh, well. we should move on and talk about the Emmys. I understand that the Emmys, there was some Emmy news this week. Is that true? Is that accurate? Was there Emmy news?
Well, there was certainly Emmy stuff that I wrote about. Whether there was actual news, I wasn't paying attention. Yeah, because I had
everything you write about is news, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, thank you.
That's my endorsement right here.
Very good. Very good. I picked five people, five actors that I wanted to see, make sure they were recognized by the Emmy voters. That was my first one I did. I did that before I left on my trip. I had to crank that out. And then when I was gone, I penned a piece. When's the last time you heard that?
Pen like, on hotel stationery in Banff?
Right. When is the last time you've heard that? Right? I penned it. Hmm. I did not actually pen it. I will have to tell you that.
You type it on the computer?
I did type it. That's the crazy part. And that was about like this very, very super crowded race that we're all in for the comedy category, which I think is insane. I really do. I really think that that this is going to be super, super competitive. And I don't know, even though you've expanded it to 7 from 5, should have gone to 10. So this half-assing it drives me crazy. But man, there's so many scenarios of great series that are available to be considered. And so the quote unquote Emmy news was not news. It was just me picking the 7 that I thought should definitely get.
Interesting. No. Yeah. I missed this because it's not in the Bastard Machine blog. This is a piece that you wrote that was, that's like in the magazine portion of the Hollywood Reporter site, but I'll put it in the show notes.
And I'm sure, I'm sure probably, since I didn't get to look at it when I was gone, I'm sure they edited it because it was pretty long. And usually I write long knowing that it'll be cut for the magazine, but that the full version of what I wanted to say will go online. But sometimes when I'm not around to actually take that long version and post it, like say if you're walking around Banff,
yeah,
having a great time, they might say, you know what, it's time to roll that story out. Let's go with the short version where we cut everything out of. So yeah, I think that's what happened. But here's the people I picked for who I wanted to be considered for Emmy nominations. And sometimes you have a little sway. Who knows? Maybe at the last second the voters take a look at a Hollywood Reporter, and there it is, open to a certain page, and they're like, hey.
I got some suggestions right here. I could just I could fill these in right now.
Right here. So I picked Constance Wu and Randall Park from Fresh Off the Boat, put them in as little combo to get more people in this pick five scenario. And they're tremendous. I picked James Corden and John Oliver for late night stuff. I picked somebody who I think is, I think she should have qualified as a slam dunk. Given that the show was so popular, but Taraji P. Henson, I think from Empire, she's probably going to get a note. Two people who are a little more obscure, but I would love to see them get nominated are Elvis Nolasco, who was in American Crime. I got to say, that was one of the most impressive acting performances I've seen all year, in a very subtle role. And Jaime Camil, who I talked to in Banff, from Jane the Virgin. Mm. So I hope those five certainly get noticed, because I think that those will be kind of outliers, except for Taraji P. Henson. I think those are going to be outliers.
I think they edited all your acting picks out of your story. So
they probably did.
So you got more Bastard Machine material to.
I know, right? I can just when I'm gone, anything can happen.
You can make more Emmy news. Even more news will be breaking as you post that story.
Well, here's the picks that I of the seven, and I when I got right down to it, I said, okay, you can't check or mess around. You got to pick seven. Yep. So my seven that I would pick for the nominees are Louis. Mm-hmm. Veep.
Yep.
Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. That's three. Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's a great show. That's four. Jane the Virgin, five. Transparent, which won the Golden Globe, at six. And then Fresh Off the Boat as seven. And I think you have to like take shows like Fresh Off the Boat and Brooklyn Nine-Nine and really reward them for being comedies rather than something that is complicated like Transparent. And even in some ways, Jane the Virgin, which is the only hour-long nominee in there, I think that in either case, whatever we're talking about, it's just to get that seven, just to crack that seven, would be very difficult because my list does not include two shows that are definitely going to get nominated, and that's Big Bang Theory and Modern Family. So sure. Clearly, my seven is not going to work.
Yeah, it's gonna. You're right. It's kind of a car crash of a category. It's just there's too much in there.
Oh, and the funny thing is,
good that there's good shows, good that there's good comedy out there, but
yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. And even if you were trying to think like what's everybody talking about, what's the buzz show that what's the buzz comedy that maybe people aren't paying attention to, but I keep hearing that name. And I said Broad City and Inside Amy Schumer are the ones from that's what the people who are out in front, that's what they're watching. Those are not going to get nominated, but if you're thinking about which shows, you have to include them in your little brainstorm session. And there's more of those. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh, yeah.
So there's just a ton, right? So good luck getting those seven.
So in advance, our condolences to the ones that don't get nominated. Actually, I think the news this week was that they're not going to do the, 5 a.m. nomination announcements on the Today Show.
Oh, you're right. Yes, that is. You are right about that being news, and I celebrated that. Yes, thank you. Please don't make me wake up at 5 o'clock.
Another little brick in the wall of changing the Emmy Awards. Does the Today Show really need? Does everybody need to deal with this because they want to put it on the Today Show?
Yeah, it's really stupid. It's just like you know what? Release it sometime in the afternoon. It'll still get covered.
Yeah, stream it live on the internet.
Absolutely. There's a thing called the internet.
And people on the internet are awake at good times that aren't 5 a.m. So
awake at good times
for your consideration.
I think you might want to consider that as title to this podcast. Awake at good times.
All right, fair
enough.
It
makes no sense, but it certainly is intriguing.
It's a thing. I have a little note down here to talk about nerdy things because because they're things that you won't review.
And I made you do it.
And
or
yes.
Will do it.
Yes. I haven't. So Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, based on a book I liked a lot, and it's getting very good reviews from people who deigned to review it.
Good.
It's coming out Saturday, tomorrow as we record this, on BBC America. And I'm really looking forward to that. Sense8 on Netflix, which is by the Wachowskis and Joe Straczynski.
Not getting good reviews.
Yeah, I saw the first episode and I thought it was okay, but I feel like I was also watching. It felt more than Daredevil, more than a lot of these Netflix dramas. It did not feel like it was an episode of a show. It really just felt like it was hour one of an extended story. So I'm going to give it an incomplete. I actually kind of am intrigued by it. I really like the fact that they shot it in all these different cities and it's got a real international feel. They have these distinctive characters in these different locations. And I like the mystery they set up in the very first scene with Daryl Hannah and Naveen Andrews. I think without that scene, the show would be really problematic because it would be like – like just playing a little what if game, but that the first scene gives it some dramatic tension that there is a darker, stranger underlying story that's happening in addition to these people. So I'm interested in it. I will say, and I say this as somebody who actually loved Babylon 5 in the 90s, that Joe Straczynski is a really smart guy and he's got a lot of great ideas. And sometimes he writes dialogue that I will quote for decades, and other times he writes dialogue and it just makes me cry because it's not very good. And it was a little bit of both. And there are some characters that I think are very well written and some characters that are really poorly written in Sense8. So I don't know. Incomplete. Like I said, I will report back. I'm going to watch more episodes of it. But, you know, if you've got Netflix, it's all right there. So you can see if it's your cup of tea or not. But I think you're going to need more than 1 hour because I don't think hour one's going to sell you on it. I think you're going to need to watch 2 or 3 hours before you make a decision.
I kind of like the idea that I may now start using incomplete. That's the thing. Incomplete!
That's right. You know, it's like you got to come back in the summer and do some extra work before you get a grade.
Polish this up.
You haven't shown me enough here, Mr. Goodman.
Summer school.
I'm going to need several more essays before I can
frowny face.
Give you your F.
See me. See me after class.
See me. Frowny face. That was the worst. See me.
See me.
That was, that's not good. Mm-hmm. I had a friend once who didn't get an F. I'm like, all right, good. Because he was really worried. He's like, yeah, I got to see me. No, that's worse. That's worse. This is such an F that we need to talk to see if you're actually sentient. Dark Matter, which we mentioned last week, that's the one from the Stargate producers.
Yes, the guys
Malazzi
you
and Mully. Mm-hmm. And it's got, I looked at a picture on Sci-Fi, this is on the Sci-Fi channel, and it made me laugh. The picture did, not because it looked ridiculous. It's just that I recognized.
Good.
Well, no, it's that I recognize familiar Vancouver actors because it's like literally the same actors are in every show that's shot in Vancouver. So it was that. It was like, oh, it's that guy from Stargate and that guy from Continuum, and you know, it's all of the same actors. But I will watch Dark. I've never read the graphic novel, but I will watch Dark Matter and I'll report back about that.
We should have a thing where it's just. When we talk about – we should say it also stars our friends in Vancouver.
Our friends from Vancouver are here. Yes. Well, I mean, you know, like so many shows, it's like it's set in a tree-lined evergreen forest area in the Pacific Northwest. Yep. They shot that in Vancouver. That's what that means. It means Vancouver. It's like the X-Files. We're investigating – the X-Files always seem to investigate things in Wisconsin and in Oregon and Idaho. And it's like, huh, I wonder why. Maybe it's the evergreen forests that were in Vancouver. So,
By the way, you want to know something I heard?
Huh.
Relating to our Vancouver/Toronto joke that we keep making?
Yeah.
I hear that Alberta, which is the home – you know, that's the province where Banff is.
Indeed.
Alberta, which is the rocky –
Rocky Mountains, yeah.
Hardy area.
Yeah.
They are making a move to steal production from Vancouver.
Interesting.
Well, because Vancouver, who – and I don't know this. I'm sure our Canadian friends, our friends in the north, will correct me on this. But what I heard was that after years and years and years of having like, oh, yes, it's guaranteed that 75,000 shows will shoot in Vancouver, apparently Vancouver, the city – has decided that they're not going to give as many tax credits as they had in the past. And you know what that means.
It means this is the thing with entertainment tax credits is as soon as they dry up, everybody leaves.
Yep.
They don't create a sustainable industry. I mean, Vancouver's been doing it so long, I'm sure they would keep – they've got the studios and they've got the producers and they've got the actors. But yeah, they just – I have friends in the visual effects industry and it's the same thing. Some, you know – there'll be tax credits in New Mexico for VFX, and they'll set up a VFX studio there, and then the tax credits expire, and they shut it down, and they go to it's like a floating crap game. Who's got the money this month? And so it's Florida. We're going to work in Florida this month, and then they move on to somewhere else. So that's interesting. I have friends in Alberta. I have friends in Calgary and in Edmonton. So that would be that. There's certainly, I think, more variety of scenery there. I mean, if you're a show, it's all about the location shooting, right? Like what kind of landscape can you stand in for to convince somebody that they're in the Old West or I don't know.
Right. But in the X-Files. Speaking of friends in Calgary, you know what happened? Do you not know what happened?
Did you meet a fan? Did you meet a listener?
Yes, I did. You know who that listener would be?
I believe that was Jason in Calgary.
It's Calgary, but yes.
Calgary. I'm going to just say Calgary because that's a callback.
Well, that's a callback to what Joe said, right?
To pronounce it wrong. Exactly.
And it's funny. I was telling, yes. And so Jason came, and I put this picture out on Twitter and Instagram. And I said, this crazy man drove more than an hour and a half from Calgary to Banff just to have drinks with yours truly. So we had a couple of pints and a burger and some fries with poutine. And right?
Get some applause.
Getting it done. And I got the full story behind the flat bastard going at Ceausescu's
grave. Oh.
Yeah. It is a doozy. I'll tell it another time.
That's my all-time favorite TV Talk Machine thing ever was the flat bastard at Ceausescu's grave.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And like all Canadians, or all Canadians that we seem to run into, what a very nice man.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Very nice man. So I enjoyed my time.
That's great.
That was good. And also, I think, you know what another thing it does, by the way?
Yeah.
Other Jason, since I was with uh-huh. Jason, the other Jason. I think going out with Jason is great because now I want to have people like Joe, who, by the way, Joe used to be Question Boy on the podcast, the old podcast, who actually doesn't know that I saw Jason with the Ceausescu fame. It takes away them joking with me that I will only go meet up with really good looking female fans. So sweet. There you go.
It's good. It's the exception that proves the rule. I was Joe
who
said that.
You are such a buzzkill.
but so that's great. I mean, thank you, Jason. That's really cool.
Yes, that he
did that. Mm. The other nerdy show that you pointed me at is Killjoys.
Oh yeah, uh-huh.
Which premieres June 19th on Sci-Fi, and that's yet speaking of Canada, that is a Canadian co-production. So it's on the Space Channel in Canada and Sci-Fi in the U.S.
I love the fact that you have been super busy with a bunch of Apple news, and yet here I throw four or five things on your plate.
I know. Well, you know, the Apple news is done now, right? So mm-hmm. I just am going to sit around the house and watch nerdy shows and report back.
Yeah, and really, I didn't do it. Basically, our fans, our listeners really demanded that you go do that.
And I also have James Patterson Zoo on my queue because...
I don't know why that's so funny. That's not a show I'd ever watch.
No, that's why, yes. But I'm hoping for some CSI cyber magic there, so we'll see.
Oh, yes.
You want to do some listener letters?
Let's do that.
All right. O-Dog in the 732.
Wow.
Yeah. How about that? I don't know where the 732 area code is.
I don't even know what an O-Dog is.
I don't know what that's an O-Dog like is. 732 is New Jersey.
Oh, okay. Now I know what it is. Now he's the original. Yeah, he's original.
Yeah.
He's trying to be like, he's like an OG, but he's O-Dog.
He's O-Dog.
O-Dog.
O-Dog. O-Dog in the 732. He says, love the pod. I think that's right for podcast.
This guy, O-Dog, is like lingo man.
Mm-hmm.
He's like lingo king. Okay.
And there's something else that he also likes. He also likes dramas about the American Revolution because he says, Tim, I'm normally in agreement with you on shows, but you missed the boat on Turn.
Did I really?
I guess that's like maybe George Washington's boat crossing the Delaware. Just a dissenting view of Turn. Maybe, you know, O-Dog likes it.
Okay. All right.
You. I think it's an agree to disagree thing.
Did he end the email by saying, put that in your musket?
Well, this was a tweet, so it was very short.
Oh, okay.
Very short. But that was just some feedback there. I should also say, I finished Daredevil and I liked it. So I guess I'm going to dissent there. I thought it ended up pretty good.
So what you're doing right now by saying that is jumping on the piling on.
I am piling on. Although I will say, I think there are only two or three episodes where there's that moment, and you saw two of them, I think, with Daredevil. Mm-hmm. That moment where you're like, why has nobody shot this guy?
Oh, okay.
It happens toward the end. There's like a next to last episode, I think, somewhere in there at the very end, that there's another thing like that where there's a guy with a gun and Daredevil is like not really close to him and the guy is spraying bullets everywhere. And I was like, oh, there it is again. but generally that doesn't happen. Generally it makes more sense than that. So I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was good.
Okay.
So other shows are available. Let's move on. Sam is here from the 707.
Oh yes, we do know that well.
That is the north coast. That is the wine country,
mm-hmm. Sonoma.
Okay, so Sam is going to keep his normally lengthy questions brief this week. Appreciate it. NBA Finals question: have you ever heard a color commentator with a bigger axe to grind than Mark Jackson?
I don't feel it. I don't feel that. I mean that not that he's not the coach or that he wants another job. I don't know. I like Mark Jackson, and maybe I'm the I don't know. I actually put that on Twitter, and got lots and lots of people retweeting that. They were also fans of Mark. He instilled the sense of defense there. But you know, I think Steve Kerr is a better tactician. Mark Jackson does not bother me as an announcer. I'm much worse than like there's some others that drive me.
No.
Oh. Was that your Walton? I love Walton.
Yeah, I do too. So number two from Sam is, sadly counting down the final episodes of The Daily Show, he says, it appears to me Comedy Central is in trouble. Bad timing. You know now they wish they could have offered it to John Oliver before HBO. They probably would have rather given the chair to Larry Wilmore and let the new guy make his own show. Mm-hmm. He says I haven't stopped DVRing the Minority Report, but I barely watch it anymore. It's a shame because I think Wilmore would have been great on the Daily Show. And now I'm faced with the possibility of watching neither in a few months. I hate change. How will I keep in touch with politics while keeping my sanity? I'll also throw in there that I think Joe Dalian posted a tweet about the ratings, and at this point Conan's average rating has equaled the Comedy Central average rating in that time slot, mostly because that second show is down in the ratings from when Colbert was there.
I think those are actually my thoughts exactly.
Bad timing.
Well, yes, bad timing. But I have to say, unless the new guy really overcomes his initial stumble. And, you know, I'm all for giving people a fair chance, but I think a lot of people really have their minds made up already. And I think it's just such bad timing. You lose John Oliver, you lose Colbert, and you lose
Jon Stewart.
And the replacement comes out and he throws up all over himself. And Wilmore, who I love, is great, but that show is not as poppy. It's not as something or other. It's a little bit more. I don't know what, actually, but it's neither one of them is like making it work.
Tough times at Comedy Central. We'll see how
I will say in defense of Comedy Central that although their luck has turned for the worse in late night, they have developed a number of really strong comedies and scripted. So good for them on that. Their scripted stuff is really good.
Sam also says, if there were still a power rankings.
Hey, I got asked that up in Banff.
Yeah.
By somebody. Yes. So sad.
It's been a year, you know, because they closed out last season. He says, sure seems like HBO Sunday nights would be a powerhouse with Veep, Silicon Valley, and Game of Thrones on the power rankings.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
Anyway, he closes with a good Game of Thrones reference. The North remembers. Sam from the North Bay.
Oh, nice. The North remembers. Okay.
The North remembers.
Good. All right.
Winter is coming. The night is dark and full of terrors, etc. Game of Thrones. Season finale coming up on Sunday, by the way. Looking forward to
that. I know. Looking forward to that. Yeah. I don't want it to end, but I am looking forward to action. Yes.
Yeah. It feels like with the last three or four episodes, they've actually kind of kicked their plot machinery into gear. Like they've reached the point where they know exactly where they're going for the last couple of seasons. So
they might be true.
That might be true. Mm-hmm. This is from Jackson in the 780.
Wow. Yeah. I don't even know where that starts with.
Alberta. How about that?
Well, I was never on the phone, so that'll tell you something. I didn't have a roaming plan. I wasn't able to change my money before I got there. I was really out of sorts.
I think it's Edmonton. I think he's more Edmonton than
he's
Calgary.
More Edmonton. Okay.
He says, I'm routinely hearing about shows that have to meter out their special effects budgets, as some aspects of the story are more expensive than others. Game of Thrones is an example. Tim mentioned Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Do you think we're missing out on shows that someone somewhere decided a concept won't get the special effects budget it needs to properly tell the story? The Walking Dead and Battlestar Galactica both seem to do a great job with practical effects, but it seems like they may not look flashy enough to get attention these days. So, you know, do we have issues where people look at concepts and are like, it's just too expensive to make that? Or or not.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that, especially in the speculative world of television and how overcrowded and competitive it is. And shall we say, when you have showrunners who won't do a damn thing to pull their people back year after year. That's a call back to the front of the podcast, everybody. Yes,
they should feel
excellently.
Bad.
Good work, Goodman. Excellent work.
Feel bad, showrunners.
No, I think that that's an issue. And I will say to that, though, I agree that that's an issue. But to that, I will tell the brief story about John Landgraf, president of FX, talking about Battlestar Galactica. The greatest quote in the history of management by saying, if that show had $1 million more per episode, it would suck. That's true, right?
Yeah.
The reason that the show was great is because they didn't have any money. They had to be plot driven, and they had to work with very little bit of money. If they had blown everything up and they'd made it a traditional sci-fi spectacular, it would not have worked to the degree it did. I agree. I think that, yeah, more money is not always more money is more problems. You know that.
I've heard that somewhere.
Yeah, let's pour one out for Battlestar Galactica.
One more. It is Haley from the 212.
Oh, okay. Classic. New York.
Classic.
I'm loving the dress. Look, everything looks good. I bet you Haley is like, you know, a typical New Yorker. You know, I always think of them as well-dressed.
So Haley says, I recently found the gem that is TV Talk Machine.
Oh.
This week I've been binging your show that encapsulates my obsession with TV in the best way possible. So I just finished episode 22.
Wow.
So
I remember that one. It was very good.
16 more to go before she hears this. Episode 22 from February, where you discuss blue sky cable channels. I'd never heard this term before, and it gave me a eureka moment. Ironically, Eureka, also a blue sky show. When I realized why I enjoy classic USA Network shows like White Collar, Burn Notice, and Suits so much, I was interested to hear more about what would have to change for channels like USA, TNT, and TBS to be taken more seriously by the critics. These three have changed a lot in recent years, shifting darker with Major Crimes, Dig, and Murder in the First type series. So do blue sky cable channels still exist when everyone wants critical acclaim and awards for their scripted programs? Do we just focus on the series and not the cable network branding? It's hard to move away from the branding aspect of these networks when you think about the series, but for me, it's all linked. What do you think?
Well, I think that they all made a very big mistake trying to go darker. Oh. I think that even though blue sky is, I don't think it necessarily as a negative term. I think when there's a lot of those shows, it becomes a little bit more like a network programming, and you don't see quite the cableness of it. But boy, the shows that she mentions in that group, those were good times, you know. And there is something I find successful about an entertaining show, because that's literally what television was for in the first place. Just here I am, entertain me. So I think by trying to get more critical acclaim and going darker, they had not done a good job of that, and therefore they haven't been able to stand out. Should go back.
That's right.
Take the gray out of the skies, Jason.
Yeah, there's different approaches here. You can have the critically acclaimed channel, but in the end, these companies want to make money. They want to have viewers and make money. And critical acclaim can help with success, but it doesn't always guarantee it. And you know, USA has a very good business at making people happy watching, you know, Monk and things like that.
Oh yeah. Well, the current one that bears watching, and it's like, you know, good ideas, bad formula. I don't know. It's like when Kevin O'Reilly took over for TNT, you just want to say, I'm sure he wanted to turn it in. I guess that was the idea. And everybody said he's going to turn a cable channel and he's going to make it like FX again. The problem is that the TNT shows that are light and airy, they do really well. They do good numbers. So why would you tinker with that formula? I wouldn't. So maybe it's not going to be a challenge for Riley. I don't know.
All right. Okay, we've reached the end. That's the end of our feedback.
Do you ever get this feeling, Jason, that there's too much television?
Yes. I feel the times of confusion at all times. Every time there's a Netflix drops, like, hey, we got 13 more hours of a show for you to watch. Oh, my God.
Yeah, like I didn't get Bloodline because I was I was on assignment of some sort. But there's another one that just dropped on Netflix, and someone in Canada asked me about it. Someone at Banff, they said, I think they actually made it. They made the show, and I can't even remember it. I'm like, you know what? Didn't that just premiere two weeks ago?
There's that one Netflix show that is a co-production with Canada, and so they it's timed with their release in Canada, so it actually doesn't drop in a binge. It dropped one at a time.
Okay, that's got to be it, because they were in Canada. And I was like, no, I do not know that show.
Yeah, it's I forget the name of it, but yeah, there is so much. It took me weeks to finish Daredevil, and I finished Daredevil, and the next day Sense8 dropped. I'm like, God. And I did watch the first episode of Bloodline, and I thought it was pretty good. But it's like, mm-hmm. you know, again, there is so much, and I've got shows from this season that I just stocked on the VCR or VCR, the DVR. I put in a videotape, a VHS tape. I just have stopped. It's like all 13 episodes, all 15 episodes are just sitting there because I got behind, and I thought I'm just going to save that for the summertime. So like Orphan Black, I'm actually way behind on, and I just figured, look, I'm going to have a really good time when all the other shows go off the air, sitting down and spending a week essentially binging on Orphan Black. But you know, there's just so much stacked up. So I absolutely there's just too much good TV right now.
Yeah, it's really something. Every time we get to the point where we'd say it and say it over and over again, but there it is, boy. I was just like, I just exhaled and said, no, I'm sorry. I've heard of your show. I have not watched it.
So I will also point out for those who disagree and think that there is that they want even more good TV on television today, that all 12 seasons of Murder, She Wrote are also available for streaming on Netflix. So. There's always something to watch.
The bloody streets of Cabot Cove.
Poor, Angela, she lost everybody. Oh, she lost God. All her relatives, all her friends. Tom Bosley, everybody died. She was very unlucky.
Or was she?
Or what? Well, that's the thing. Is
that was my theory.
We always called it murder she caused because she clearly had to be involved. Clearly.
Yeah. She was a terrible influence. It was a little sleepy town, and then the blood runs in the streets now.
She needed raw material for her books, and she just couldn't stop killing.
She couldn't
to get
stop
it.
Killing. I know. Oh, my God. You know what? That sounds like the third episode of True Detective.
It's True Detective Season 3. It's Angela Lansbury and Tom Bosley, the ghost of Tom Bosley, I suppose, at this point. But they'll recast, but it'll still be Jessica Fletcher. Yeah.
Too funny.
True Detective author. Perhaps will be the name of it. All right. Well,
I think I've just become totally punch drunk.
I think we're. Yeah, I think that sound I hear is us being done. So Tim, it's been a pleasure as always. 38 in the books.
Being done. Yes, the sound of being done. 38 in the books. How about that?
38 in the books. Next week we'll go for 39.
Excellent.
Okay. Welcome back. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody out there. You can, I remember to give the numbers this time. So tweet Tim at Bastard Machine, tweet me at Jay Snell, tweet the podcast at TVTM. You can visit the Facebook page. I didn't read anything from the Facebook page today because reasons, but facebook.com/TV Talk Machine. And you can send us emails, podcast@TVTalkMachine.com. And we look forward to hearing from you. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye, everybody.